I'm having this nonverbal discussion with the mosquito. I don't want to smack it. I try to convince it to kind of shoo away. So we talked yesterday about, wow, a whole lot of things. But one of the things, you know, to carry on with what Frank is saying is that there is within us a sense of language is really interesting, because there is within us, as we communicate, a sense of a start, a middle, and an end. Right? So sentences have a subject, verb, object. There's little punctuations that tell you where to stop, when to pause, when to move on. And our thinking tends to be that way as well. And for the most part, the way we conceptualize the world is that way. We tend to see it as truncated into these little pieces that we engage with. And as Frank said, you know, we come into a particular environment, we behave in a particular way that's congruent with that environment. A whole lot of social psychology studies that show that. We have cues that tell us what to do, and this is where consumption is a really interesting perspective, in that craving and urges are triggered by certain cues. It doesn't matter whether you've highly trained yourself out of responding to those urges or not, those cues will always be there. Right? Which is why attending to the sensations that come up in our body is such an important thing. So one of the things that came up that we talked about, and has come up through our conversations with all of you, is that we tend to be looking for a place in which we can have what we want out of our practice. You know, the peace of mind, the calm, the ease, things like that. And we talked about going for the things that you want, looking for the things that are good for you. Looking at ways to be good to yourself. Looking at ways to fill your life so that it's meaningful and purposeful. And I was reminded of two things. One is my favorite my favorite verse in the Tao Te Ching, chapter 11, which says, a wheel has eight spokes, or a wheel has spokes, and it's the space between the spokes that makes the wheel usable. A room has four walls, but it's the emptiness in the room that makes it beneficial. A bowl is hollow, and it's that space in the hollowness that allows it to be used for its purpose. We tend to think of usefulness as the concrete stuff that surrounds us. So, you know, the table is useful, the chair is useful. My life is useful because it's solid and it's complete and it has all these things in it. Well, what we forget is that those things can't exist unless there's space between them. Otherwise, we'd have this big jelly mass in our life, right? That wouldn't function. But we tend to push away that emptiness. We tend to experience that emptiness as something that is wrong with us, as something that has to be filled, as opposed to the space that defines all the other things, all the other aspects of our life. And this is a tricky concept. Right? It's a tricky concept. I got a letter from a practitioner that said, it was kind of sad, and they said, I go to all these retreats, I go to all these talks, and nothing is really satisfying, because, you know, everybody talks about emptiness. Emptiness is a very technical term and a very deep philosophical term in Buddhism. Everybody talks about emptiness, and I know all about emptiness. And I thought, wow, if you know all about emptiness, maybe we should all be coming to you, because even the most skilled of philosophers can't quite explain what shunyata or emptiness actually means. But in effect, what we try to express it as, it's a deep interconnectedness. The space and the object that defines the space are intimately connected. You can't have one without the other. Your bottle, your water bottles would be useless if there was no space in them. Right? Your teacup would be pointless if there wasn't space in it. So is it really a teacup if there wasn't space in it? You know, it might be a great sort of doorstopper, or it might be a great bookend, but it wouldn't be a teacup. So when you look at your life that way, you look at how we conceptualize through language what our understanding is of our life, and you try to look at our life as the kind of worry that we have about these spaces. You know, that's why silent retreats are so powerful. You get to experience what it's really like to be bored. You know, what is this phenomenon of boredness? Right? What does it feel like to have nothing to do? And into that space pops everything you never wanted to really confront and face. Right? So it's really important to look at not just all the things that define us, but all the spaces in between. Some of the spaces could be very dark. Joan Halifax wrote a beautiful book called A Fruitful Darkness. Some of those spaces can be very dark, and we can think that we're never going to come out of them. But it's really important to be there, because it's in that space that things cook. You know, coming back to the chickpea, right? The poor little chickpea wouldn't have anywhere to cook if the pot didn't have space in it. So it's in that space that things cook. And it's in that space that we find our greatest challenge. Because we're such consuming creatures, right? We're like that little, you know, I don't know if you remember the Pac-Man, you know? we're like, yeah, the naps, you know, right in there, the wanting creature. What is this, you know, what is this that you crave after? Is there any space where the soul will be less thirsty? Interestingly, the definition, the cause of suffering, as Buddhist philosophy outlines, the cause of suffering, the word is used, is tana, and tana is translated as thirst. We're constantly thirsty. We want. We want something. I was so excited there were hard-boiled eggs this morning. I was just thrilled. I could eat like a dozen of them in one sitting, you know. My heart wouldn't like it, but my heart can go deal with it later. So I promised myself, as I'm standing in line and I'm thinking, I saw it and I went, okay, pancakes. I love pancakes, but not as much as hard-boiled eggs. Really want some hard-boiled eggs. How long has it been since I've had hard-boiled eggs? Like maybe 2 days, maybe a day and a half? That's way too long. So I get up there and I make a commitment. I'm only going to have one hard-boiled egg. I am convinced that this universe would not exist if one only ate one hard-boiled egg. Hard-boiled eggs come in pairs. You've got to eat them in pairs. Right? That poor little odd hard-boiled egg floating around without its partner. Be like me without Frank. You know, really.
I didn't eat any hard-boiled eggs, so you could have two.
So I get up there, and I can feel this. This world is not going to work if I only have one hard-boiled egg. Now, I'm serious. I really am thinking this. And you think I'm normal, huh? And I've got this obsessive-compulsive thing going on in my head that's saying, I don't know if I can do this. You know? And I'm going, okay, just take one. Just take one. Breathe. It's okay. It's going to be all right. Just take one. You can have two pancakes. You take two pancakes, but you're going to have yogurt. If you're going to take two pancakes, you've got to have yogurt. So I'm negotiating with myself. What's the healthiest thing I can get away with here? All the while in the back of my head, I'm thinking, I'm coming back for that second one. I don't care what you say. I'm coming back for that second one, right? So I'm eating this. I'm sitting out there. Beautiful day to sit out there, and I'm out there, and I'm thinking, savor the environment. Maybe you won't want that extra hard-boiled egg. Savor the environment. Look at the scenery. Look at all these beautiful people eating so mindfully. They must be on a retreat or something. Yeah? You guys are so awesome. I was watching you and I'm thinking, wow. I really was. I was just looking at this and going, you don't need that other hard-boiled egg. This beautiful, beautiful experience in front of you. You know, why is your soul thirsting after another hard-boiled egg? So I go and get another one. Because you can't debate with yourself. Right? I said last night, I've never won a debate with myself. So you surrender to the hard-boiled egg. Right? But I surrender to the craving. This is just, you know, my mind is on this rut. It is going. But I was quite pleased with myself. I didn't have three pancakes, a hard-boiled egg, and the oatmeal. Little victories. You got to go for the little victories. But it was interesting to notice how demanding that thought was. You always have two hard-boiled eggs. I don't care if there are two pancakes on your plate and that's more than enough. I don't care that you've got a large glass of orange juice instead of a small one. You always have two hard-boiled eggs. So when I do that, I'm living in the structure and not in the space. I'm living in this cage of rules that dictates to me how my life is going to be. And I'm not living in the spaciousness of noticing that two pancakes and one hard-boiled egg with lovely blueberries and strawberries and yogurt was a generous helping for breakfast. I'm caught in that craving. And once we're caught in that craving, and once that train's left the station, it's really hard to turn it around. Now, you know, we're talking hard-boiled eggs, which is not a huge danger to my life, but, you know, I can think of all the other things that I do that set me off on that track. And unless I'm willing to take responsibility for my own experience and my own craving, there's no turning that train around. It's absolutely no turning that train around. And that craving comes in so many different ways. You know, the ego is constantly thirsty. The heart is constantly aching for something more. It's yearning to be fulfilled in some way. And it's counterintuitive to stop. It's counterintuitive to say, what's the spaciousness here? How much movement have we got? So when that happens, we end up splitting ourselves in many, many different ways. You know, I become the psychologist, I become the mother, I become the spouse, I become, you know, the gardener, I split myself in all these ways, and these become the structures in my life, and I lose sight of the spaciousness that makes my life actually beneficial. Mm-hmm. So I get caught in my identity, and I consume that. That's a consumption. I get caught in that identity of this is who I am, this is who I have to be. And it's tricky not to, because at one level you want to acknowledge who you are. At another level, it's easy that that becomes a Velcro spot. You get caught to that. Right? We do. We all do. So you know there's a story coming. Right? I love this story. I think it's a really powerful, it comes from a Chinese folktale. It's an absolutely powerful, powerful story. And it's a story of Senjo and her soul. And in Zen traditions, the question is, who is the real Senjo? Right? But I think it's just a cute nighttime story, unless you want to terrify your kids. I wouldn't suggest telling them to your kids, but it's a cute nighttime story for us. So Senjo is this lovely young woman living in somewhere in China, in some timeless time, you know, where everything was wonderful and perfect. And she grew up with her friend, whom, of course, inevitably she falls in love with. And they assume they're going to get married, and they're going to have beautiful little babies, and they're going to, you know, float around in lily ponds and have a wonderful life. And one day her father comes, and her father and her mother and all the family, and they're quite happy about this little relationship. They think, oh, this isn't it cute? They think they're in love, right? And then one day the father comes and he says, it's time for you to get married. And she thinks, oh, this is great, so now finally I get to marry the one I've loved all my life. And he says, no, no, you've been betrothed to someone else, and you have to marry this person. And so, of course, she's devastated, right? And so is he. I mean, the lover, the man that she thinks she's going to marry. So they're both devastated. They're destroyed. But there's no choice. This is ancient China, and there are rules, and you have to do and what your parents tell you to, and there's tremendous shame that comes to the village and to the family if you don't do this. And these are negotiated deals. These are financially based, status-based negotiated deals. So she realizes that she has to do this. So the lover says, well, you know, just to make it easy for you, or he decides for himself that he's, you know, just to make it easy for her, he's going to leave. So because it'd be too painful to live in the same village and not to be able to be with her. So late at night, in the moonlight, he gets in his little boat and he paddles his way, starts to paddle his way away from the dock, and he looks up at the dock, and here comes Sanjo running down the dock, going, I'm going with you. I refuse to be caught in these rules, these pointless rules, because I love you, you love me, let's go. So she gets in the boat, and you know, and at this point you're thinking, oh, good for her, all right. You go, girl. And so she gets in the boat and off she goes. And the two of them go. And they leave and they go to another part of the country. And they have children and they have this wonderful life and this incredible happy life. And 5 years goes by, I think 5 years go by. And she starts to feel like, you know, we've got children, we've got 3 children, and we really want to reconcile with my family. So they go, they decide, okay, we're going to go back. We'll go back. And so she has made this choice about her life, that this is the shape and the frame of the life that she wants. So she goes back thinking, well, even if they've suffered tremendous shame, even if they've been ostracized, even if they've been, you know, maligned in this village, I'm still their daughter. They're bound to welcome me back. She has tremendous faith in the familial connection. So she goes back, and her husband says, oh, hang on a second, let me go and talk to your father. Because, you know, if he should be mad at anyone, it should be me, right? Because I took you. I could have said no, I took you. So brave young man that he is, he goes up to see the father, and the father's like, oh my gosh, what are you doing here? You know, you left 5 years ago and we haven't seen you. What's going on? And he says, you know, I'm really sorry, but you know, sorry for what we did. We want to come back. We want to reconcile. We, you know, we're here. Can we make up? And the father's perplexed and he says, I don't understand. What are you talking about, we? And he says, well, Sanjo and I are really sorry for what we did. You have grandchildren now. We would like to come home and reconcile. And he says, I don't understand. He says, no, what do you mean, Sanjo? Who are you bringing back? And they're both now really perplexed, right? And the father says, well, the day you left, the night you left, Sanjo went to her room. She lay down and she hasn't gotten up since. So the question is, who is the real Sanjo? The one who left, the one who stayed behind, the one who was alive, the one who was disconnected. Who is the real Sanjo? That's a powerful question in our own lives. Right? How often do we go after something, as beautiful as that may seem, as right as it may seem, as powerful and fulfilling as it may seem, what do we leave behind? You know, what's the impact? What's the impact, the unseen consequences of what we do? What keeps us from going running down that dock and saying, this is what I really want? What has us going back into our room and lying down and saying, no, I don't want this life? I don't know what the answer is as to which is the real Sanjo. But I know in my life when I've been one or the other, or both at the same time, right? Probably most of us have been both at the same time, right? Yeah. It's a powerful teaching story. It's a powerful, and this is the beauty of Zen koans, is that they're not just these mysterious things that we try and, you know, gnaw at and come up with intellectual answers, but they're deep felt resonant experiences of our life. Just like the tree falling in the forest. If you're not there, it's not your sound. So this to me really typifies that issue of what we chase after, what we give up, how we give up, how we surrender, how we split ourselves. Because consumption works both ways. We consume by chasing, and we consume by surrendering. It goes both ways. So, you know, work with that one. Work with that one. Let it cook. Let it cook in your life. Notice those moments when you're making these choices and really drop into, what is this choice that I'm really making? You know, at a funny level, it's about one hard-boiled egg or two. But at a really profound level, it's about the life I want to live and the life I make myself live. Because I'm so caught in all my assumptions about discontinuity. You know, here was my life. I was a student. Now I don't know what to do. You know, I was this, now I'm that. These are fabrications. These are constructions. Life is continuous. You know, it's Eddie Hillesum's quote, you know, my life has been one long, continuous inner miracle. It's that continuity that we miss. So the space between the wheels is continuous with the spokes. The space in the cup is continuous with the edges of the cup. One can't exist without the other. So time's running out. And here we are at the end of our retreat. In a microcosmic sense, you've lived out in these 2 days exactly what your life is. You've been living your life like this. You just haven't noticed. We take away all the edges. Welcome to your life. Yeah, we started out probably on Friday. I hope we all started out with a tremendous sense of feeling our commitment really strongly, practicing how to be with ourselves, being determined to face this inner person, right? Being careful with our pain, taking care of ourselves, sleeping if we need to, resting. We've been eating quietly with reverence, you know, savoring the sunshine when it came, by the way. Savoring the rain, too. I mean, it was really quite beautiful, you know, with the rain and the wind last night. It was beautiful. So notice that in these 2 days, you held this container of practice continuously. Right? There's not been a single break in your practice. Or as we like to say in our programs, in our classes, you know, there is no break in life. You kind of have to find that space for yourself. And we're also probably thinking, wow, this is so different from my real life, this is the unreal life. That's the real life, right? Yeah. And now I'm thinking about re-entering that life. How do I re-enter that life? As if it's, you know, my life is out there and I'm over here. So which Senjo are you? Are you the passive one here or the really active one, right? Be a little scary if we went home and our dog sitter said, "What do you mean you were gone? You've been upstairs all this time." I just thought of that. Well, okay. Hope she takes the dogs and goes home. So the truth, though, is that, you know, in all reality, you haven't left your life, right? You haven't left your life. It's been right here with you. And not just because you've been checking your emails and your iPhones and things like that. But your life has been here with you all along. And it's been out there, too, but it's been with you all along here. So this is our practice. This is our practice to see that it's continuous. It never stops. Wherever you go, Confucius, a beautiful Confucius quote, wherever you go, there you are. Mm-hmm. There you are. So all of that is called showing up. We show up. So thank you for showing up. So I'll close with this particular talk and then we'll reconfigure the room. This is a reading from a new book by Karen Mazin Miller. The new book is Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. Each of us walks along a path with no sign of where we've been and no knowledge of where we'll end up. The earth rises to meet the soles of our feet, and out of nowhere comes a gift to support and sustain our awareness, which is our life. Some days that gift is a bite, and some days it's a banquet. Either way, it's enough.